All right. We are going to start this semester, which will last all of 3 weeks, before next semester. Then we'll take, obviously, a break for winter vacation, with chapter 27. But I want to give some background just to what we do and how we do it and how to come into the class if you're here for the first time, which is, first of all, that you should just bring any English Bible. If you read Hebrew, you can bring an English and Hebrew Bible. Ideal is to bring a Bible and not a Chumash. A Chumash is what we use for the Chumash, the five books, is what we use, for example, in the synagogue to read from, right? But that doesn't have the entire Bible in it. And if we make reference to Judges or to Chronicles or to one of the prophets, you won't have it. So really what you want is the Tanakh. The Tanakh is the entire Bible. That's why this is the JPS Tanakh, which is the one that I recommend for easy reading, but it doesn't really matter which one you get. The Tanakh is composed of the Torah, that is the five books, Nevi'im, which are the prophets and some of the historical books, and Ketuvim, which are all the other books, Job, Proverbs, Psalms, Ruth, Jonah, all those books that you know vaguely are Jewish sacred books, but you never actually see them in the thing that they give you in the synagogue, and you wonder why. The reason is because they're part of the Bible, but they're not part of the five books of Moses, which is sometimes confusingly called the Torah. The reason that it's confusing is the Torah is sometimes the five books, sometimes the Torah is all of the Tanakh, and sometimes the Torah is all Jewish sacred writings. So someone will say, are you studying Torah? And if you answer yes, it doesn't necessarily mean that you're studying this book. You could be studying the Talmud, and you're still studying Torah. So Torah is a multi-purpose word, but what we're looking for in this class is we're studying the first book of the Torah by any definition, which is Genesis, Bereshit. But as you'll see, in order to understand it, you often have to make reference to later books, and that's why it's good. Besides, it's good for every Jewish home to have a Tanakh anyway. This comes in lots of different sizes and editions, but you can also get lots of other translations, and sometimes, as people know, different translations have helped illuminate different ideas in the Tanakh, because remember that one of the remarkable things about translating the Torah is the Torah is the only real example of ancient Hebrew that we have. It's not like there are lots of other books. They're later. The books that are in Hebrew are much later. So there are many, many words in the Torah that are disputed, that are argued among the rabbis and among later scholars, and translations are tricky, and a little change in nuance can mean a change in the entire story, just as when you talk to someone, you know, when you say you didn't hear their tone of voice can mean everything, so in a written text, so can the way that you render it. If you've ever heard, for example, a short story, they used to do that on National Public Radio, don't know if they still do. They used to read short stories aloud. If you ever hear a short story or anything else read aloud and you've already read it to yourself, you see it's two different experiences, just two different experiences. So the rabbi said that you should read the Torah like a love letter, which is you read everything over and over again. You say, what did he mean by that? Why did he say this and not that? And with that kind of attention, and that's what we try to do here, taking into account both the tradition, the psychology of the characters, and other things that occur to us along the way. Okay, any questions before we... Yeah, please,
Marsha. You prefer the Tanakh to the Eitz Chaim?
The Eitz Chaim is not a Tanakh. The Eitz Chaim is the thing that you use in synagogue. Would you hold it up? This book that we use in synagogue is the JPS translation of the five books of Moses and the Haftarot. The Haftarot are selections from the rest of this book, actually from Nevi'im. But it's not the complete Bible. The complete Bible is only if it says Bible, Tanakh, complete Bible, something like that. Now you should know that if you get a Christian Bible, interestingly enough, like the New Oxford edition of the Bible or something like that, you will get not only the New Testament, but you will get the entire Hebrew Bible. The one difference, well, the major difference being that it's not always in the same order. And Catholic and Protestant versions of the Bibles have different orders. And that some books are included that we don't include, like the book of Tobit, which is apocrypha in Jewish tradition. That is, it was written by ancient Jews, but it was never put into the Bible. Yeah. The Pentateuch is the five books of Moses. The Pentateuch means the Torah. That's why penta, like pentagon, Pentateuch. All right, any other? No? Okay, great. All right, so, but having said that, we'll primarily spend our time, obviously, in Genesis, and any translation that you have will do for now, but we'll be reading from the JPS translation, which is the one you'll find in the Eitz Chaim and in anything that says JPS on it. Okay, that's the Jewish Publication Society, which publishes in part the Eitz Chaim as well as this translation. Okay, so chapter 27. Now, also, you'll have to get used to looking for chapter and verses because we can't call out page numbers since everybody's got a different edition, okay? So you're looking for Genesis, Bereshit, chapter 27, verse 1. All right? If someone knows what page it is in the Eitz Chaim, you can call it out. 153, if you have the red book, 153. You have to just find chapter 27, okay? Now, I thought I would start with this because we're really doing this year, and my guess is next year too, the story of Jacob. So I thought, let's go back and start at the beginning of the story of Jacob, not with his birth, where Rachel is having Jacob and Esau struggle in the womb, because I didn't want to go that far back, but at least far enough back to the blessing, to the robbery of the blessing, so to speak. And I'm not going to spend too much time on it because we spent a lot of time on it last year. And those who are interested, all the old classes are online. So you can always listen to previous classes. All right, chapter 27. When Isaac was old and his eyes were too dim to see, he called his older son Esau and said to him, "My son," and he answered, "Here I am." Okay? Now, I just started reading this book that it won an award for thought or history or whatever in England. It's called The Long Life. And it talks about how philosophers and literature, certain philosophers and certain literature, treat old age. And what I realized was, it's interesting, the woman who wrote it says, you know, at the beginning, since everybody's going to ask how old I was when I wrote this, she wrote it actually young, between 37 and 42. But it's filled with speculation about old age and whether old age, among other things, is a diminishment or a flourishing, whether it frees you from like racking bodily desires, or in fact, what it does is it drains life of color because you no longer have those desires, and lots of other issues. And because I'm in the middle of reading the book, when I looked at this, I realized that we don't spend a lot of time thinking about what the Bible's trying to tell us about Isaac and age here. We tend to concentrate on Esau and Jacob because that's the drama of the story. But really, this is the first depiction that I can think of, even though Sarah and Abraham get old and die, and everyone else gets old and dies, I can't think of a previous depiction just now offhand, and maybe one of you can, of old age in the Bible. This is really the first statement, and what it says about it, at least as far as I remember, is that his eyes were too dim to see, and he calls Esau over to give him the blessing, which raises for me two questions. One is, I understand why he has to say his eyes were too dim to see, otherwise how's he going to mix up the birthright, right? He's got to have eyes too dim to see, and you know the rabbis talk about that, and they give all sorts of reasons why Isaac's eyes were too dim to see, including the tears of the angel that dropped into his eyes at the time of the Akedah, when Abraham bound him on the altar and the angels wept and the tears dropped into his eyes and apparently blinded him or near blinded him. Or we've talked about maybe cataracts, who knows. However, What's interesting to me is that he decides now is when he has to bless Esau. Presumably, look at the, if you look in the end of verse 4, he says, Tivarechecha nafshi b'terem amut, which the English translates is that I may give you my innermost blessing. It, nafshi, nefesh is what? My soul's blessing, right? Is the literal translation is my soul's blessing. But the question is, why can't he give him his soul's blessing before he's old and about to die? So it's also another image of, I think, a little bit being suspended between two worlds. And we have this sense that somebody who's close to death somehow has more, like a dying blessing has more power, like dying wishes have more power. Why does someone's last wish have more power than their third to last wish or their fifth to last wish, right? In fact, you might argue that that should have more power, since after all, that's when they're still going to be alive to see if it's realized or not. But there is this sense of being suspended between worlds that Isaac is somehow, his blessing is more powerful at this moment. And so he's been waiting until he's close to dying. And so you get both images of old age here. One image of it being more powerful spiritually and an image of it being less powerful physically. And both of those are interesting to note as we look at Isaac's conduct through all this, because he's, even though what we're really going to follow is Jacob, it's Isaac who makes all this possible, obviously, with Rebecca pulling the strings. Okay, so he says, I'm old now and I don't know how soon I may die. Take your gear, your quiver and bow, go out into the open and hunt me some game. Prepare a dish such as I like, bring it to me to eat, so that I may give you my innermost blessing. It does say so that in the Hebrew, ba'avur. Now, why does Esau have to do this in order for Isaac to give him the blessing? Why doesn't he say, and I will give you the blessing? Which he could easily do, right? He could say, do all this, and I will give you my blessing. But he doesn't say that. He says, do this so that I can give you my blessing.
Go ahead,
Adam. But why?
Unless you do something, unless you are providing an offering or a service or an act of bravery, something that then a blessing can be given.
There's a lot of literature, both ancient and now modern, in fact, on gift exchange and what gift exchange means. And the way in which you assert, you know, the way in which gift exchange is both a, you know, it's both a gift and also a status symbol. Right, the giver has more status than the receiver. And the more you give, the greater your status. And when you give someone something, it's never, a gift is never a gift, right? It's never a gift. If it was just a gift, you wouldn't care that people returned it, right? How could they have returned that beautiful sweater I got them? Well, if it was a gift, you wouldn't care that they returned it, right? It's a gift, for God's sakes. But judging all of human nature from my mother, people do care, right, that you return what they give. And in fact, not only that, but they want a gift to be something that is a product of their giving. How many people say, I don't want to just give money, right? People will call you and say, what is your child want for their birthday? I don't want to just give them money. In other words, you want a stamp of personality on the gift. There's something about a gift that creates a relationship just in the giving. So here, I was just going to say, here it may be that you need to create some kind of reciprocity. The child has to do something for the parent to create that sense of both of them. Yeah, 1, 2.
It's like giving a warning, I'm doing this, so let's play the game.
Okay, so I suppose if you believe that Isaac all along really wants to give the gift to Jacob, which you could believe, although it requires a little bit of footwork, you could argue that from the text, then obviously he doesn't want to just give the blessing right then. He wants to give time, and everybody will know that Esau's out hunting, and on and on and on. And it is what makes the story possible. Yeah. Well, there are two things to that. First of all, we're dealing here not just with blessing, spiritual blessing, we're dealing with property rights. So there you actually have to say, you know, you get the business, your sister gets the house, that kind of thing. But there is another issue here, which is that human beings should work that way, but they don't. That is, in theory, children don't really owe their parents anything, right? Why should they owe their parents anything? Everything you give your child is your responsibility. You brought the child into the world. You're supposed to give them the best. Why should they owe you back for giving them the best? And yet, you know, as Lear puts it in King Lear, sharper than a serpent's tooth is an ungrateful child. Because the truth is that there is no relationship without reciprocity. Human beings just aren't built that way. And so parents do want things from their children, even though in theory, they shouldn't necessarily want things from their children. And that's the argument, by the way, that the Jewish tradition uses for why there is a commandment to honor your parents, but not a commandment to honor your children, because it assumes that honoring your children is part of the simple human nature, whereas honoring your parent, as Rabbi Shimon says in the Talmud, is the hardest of all the commandments. All I can say is, if we have lots of comments, we won't get anywhere. So please do your best to really only say something that is urgent for you to say, and I'll be happy to call on you if you do, but please do that and try to make it quick. Yeah.
I was reading before you came, and it said the reason that Isaac loved Esau was because of the venison. So if he wants his soul to be most open, perhaps he is looking for the thing that he loves most about Esau.
Right, that we,
And then to be able to be in a spiritual place, to be open and most loving.
That was the reason that we actually gave last year, if you remember, there's no reason why you would know. But if you remember when we talked about it, it was that Isaac loves Esau because Esau has this capacity to hunt and so on and so forth. So, and aren't you always better after a good meal? So Isaac, you know, after a good meal, especially provided by his son, he's going to be open. But I'm asking a sort of prior question to that, not why specifically he wants him to do this, but why he feels as though it's necessary to receive anything as a child. Yeah.
Is unconditional love a modern concept then?
It's actually, what it really is a false concept.
It's a false concept.
Yes. There is no such thing. What there is constant love. It may be that you'll love somebody no matter what they do, but that doesn't mean that your love has no conditions, because love waxes and wanes like every other human emotion, and it is impossible for a human being to have their emotions unaffected by the actions of somebody that they care deeply about. They just can't do it. So I don't know where it first came from, but I mean, let's...
The other thing is, I have my daughter who studies Torah, and she always reminds me that it is a parent's responsibility to do X, Y, and Z
yes.
in the Torah. So there are responsibilities.
There are responsibilities, although it's not clear. I mean, the rabbis elaborate them in the Talmud, but there isn't so much. There's a little bit in the Torah, but really very little about the responsibilities of the parent to the child, and most of it is derivative from stories as opposed to a direct law. Yeah. The father by feeding his father the way fathers usually feed children or parents usually feed children, so they're reversing roles, which ties into the question of old age, right? Because one of the cliches of old age is that parents become children and children become parents.
I would have said that it ties
right, and Esau is now going to be the patriarch of the family, which may be too not two sides of the same coin, but two aspects of the same switch of situation. Yeah. Right, that would make sense. Esau has to prove that he can take the head of the family, and in the ancient world, that at least for Esau, that means hunting. Marilee?
It's kind of an equalizer, isn't it? Esau, as an adult, who's parallel to the father, right?
Because he can give him that.
So that it's going in both directions.
Okay, now, Rebekah had been listening as Isaac spoke to his son Esau. Having the picture that we do of Rebekah from previous chapters, this is no surprise. My guess is that Rebekah probably had a listening device implanted in the room at the time. And also, presumably, Rebekah knew that this conversation was coming, right? Now, it may be that she knew it was coming because Isaac said, by the way, tomorrow I'm going to, you know, ask Esau to hunt and I'm going to give him the blessing. Entirely possible. It doesn't say that Rebekah didn't, I mean, there's got to be some reason why Rebekah was listening specifically to this conversation. Presumably Isaac and Esau have lots of them. When Esau had gone out into the open to hunt, hunt game to bring home, Rebekah said to her son Jacob, I overheard your father speaking to your brother Esau. There's a good example. The English uses overheard as opposed to listening. But the Hebrew, the word is the same. And that's an interpretation in translation, right? She's presenting it in the English to Jacob as though it's accidental. I happen to overhear. But the Hebrew doesn't say that, even though you could derive that from the Hebrew. But remember, among other things, biblical Hebrew has a much, much, much more limited vocabulary than modern English, which has more words than any language ever, right? So it could be, and that's, by the way, that's a great thing about the Bible, because it gives you much more room for interpretation if you use the same word over and over again, right? The more nuanced your vocabulary, the less room for interpretation. But in Hebrew, it says, shoma'at, v'rivka shoma'at, and then it says, hine shamati, which is the exact same word. By changing listening to overhearing, it makes it feel different. So, although that could be the case. Yeah.
Sorry, but hine shamati is like pitom shamati. So it is means I overheard.
Maybe. Could be. But it could also be here, behold, I've heard. Or behold, I listened. Right? Hine can also mean, a revelatory moment. It's a nice example of the possibilities of translation to influence in both a good way, but also a way that you have to be aware of your reading of the text. So bring me some game and prepare a dish for me that I may bless you with the Lord's approval before I die. Now, is that exactly what Esau said? Not exactly. Now, what does she eliminate? Right, first innermost blessing, but she eliminates something before that too, which is Esau's fearsomeness. Take your quiver and your bow and hunt. Because she's about to get Jacob to betray his brother, it's probably not a good time to remind him, by the way, he's really good with a bow and arrow. So he's going to go out and he's going to hunt the biggest, baddest game you have ever seen. Go steal the blessing. That's at least part of what I assume is going on. I mean, it's also may just be that she wants to speak quickly. She doesn't have a lot of time to set this up. But there is something about Esau's scariness that's not good to emphasize right now to Jacob, because she's obviously going to ask him to do something morally ambiguous. How about that? Yeah.
What's the word? I mean, the Lord approval was not said before.
What's that?
It says, with the Lord's approval.
Yes. No, it doesn't say with the Lord's approval before. Which is very interesting, because you assume that that's counter to her, intention, right? She shouldn't say with the Lord's approval to Jacob. I don't know why that's in there, but it's interesting to think about. interesting to think about. It says lifnei Hashem, lifnei moti, lifnei Hashem again. It could be the Lord's approval. It can also just mean before God. So I don't know which way you want to configure it. And maybe that's her explanation of my soul's blessing. Maybe that's how Rebecca sees it. Maybe Rebecca is, maybe what Rebecca is demonstrating here is a closer connection to God and a more intimate, a greater intimacy with God. And she assumes that if Isaac's blessing Esau, that God has a part in it. Yeah.
Maybe she wants to get Jacob's trust that this is all kosher.
Yeah, but then why does she say that he's blessing Esau with God's approval? Yeah. Okay, but I still think it doesn't seem to fit her purpose very well. I don't know. Anyway, I mean, I'll see if I can find more stuff about it. Now, my son, listen carefully. Since remember, this is just a review to get us up to speed, so I don't want to spend too long on it. But that's an interesting question. I'll see if I can find something about it. Now, my son, listen carefully as I instruct you. Now, by the way. Instruct you is not the Hebrew word there. What's the Hebrew word? Anybody? Mitzaveh otach. Command you, right? Mitzaveh, like mitzvah. Remember, mitzvah, even though people translate it as good deed, it doesn't mean good deed, it means commandment. A mitzvah is a commandment. Colloquially, it means, you know, do a mitzvah, help that person out, right? That means a good deed. But really, mitzvah means commandment, as is the title of one of Elliot Dorff's books. He wrote a book called Mitzvah Means Commandment. So she's telling him, you have to do this, right? And after all, she's his mother, and he's supposed to listen to what she says, except, of course, according to the tradition, according to Rashi, you're supposed to listen to your parents except when? Yes, when they tell you to do something contrary to God's will, right? In other words, against the Torah, because everyone is a child to God. And so you don't listen. It's the same thing. That's why the Israelites, that was the rationale for why the Israelites were freed from Egypt. Because everyone is a servant of God, and you can be a servant of God, but you're not allowed to be a servant of servants. Right? So here too, you listen to your parents except when they say something contrary to God's will, because you can be a child, but you can't always be a child to children. Right? Not when they tell you to do something wrong. So whether this is contrary to God's will, I guess, is the issue. Go to the flock and fetch me two choice kids, and I'll make them a dish for your father such as he likes. Now, that both implicates Rebecca, and also, according to the analysis we just had, it also makes Jacob less competent than Esau. You realize that, right? Esau could, you know, go, he could hunt, he could cook. Jacob has to get a couple of sheep inside, and Rebecca will do the rest. So it's an interesting evaluation of their qualities and capabilities that Rebecca, you can see why Rebecca likes Jacob, but among other things, he listens to his mother. I'll cook it, I'll take care of it, right. Don't worry about your father. She goes on to say, don't worry about your father, it's all my doing, don't worry, it's okay. Yes, yeah. Go ahead.
She had already gotten from the womb the idea that the blessing.
Yes, she did.
To
right.
Jacob. And so the way I read it is that she puts the Lord's approval she puts those words into Isaac's mouth because it sort of explains the urgency of this is the blessing that the Lord said you're to get. And he's saying the Lord's giving it to...
It could be. If you read, you know, it's interesting. If you read it, like, let's say that you were an actor and you wanted to read it that way. You could say, bring me some game and dish me that I may bless you with the Lord's approval. Like, can you believe that your father said that? Don't you know? I mean, we've known for years that you're the one who's supposed to get this. Yes, I suppose it's conceivable that you could do that. So, I mean, you really... If Jacob and Rebecca share this understanding, which they might, that all along he knows that he's getting the birthright and that that's what God told her, then I suppose that this is all, this reads differently, as opposed to Jacob just being an innocent who doesn't know what's going on, and Rebecca says, quick, let's go fool your father. Jacob answered his mother, Rebecca, but my brother Esau is a hairy man and I'm smooth-skinned. If my father touches me, I'll appear to him as a trickster and bring upon myself a curse, not a blessing. But his mother said, your curse, my son, be upon me. Just do as I say and go fetch him for me. And that's a crucial moment. First of all, because here's where what Jacob believes and what Jacob is like really matters. Jacob changes a lot in the course of the Bible, more than I think any other character, certainly in Genesis and maybe in all of the five books. Even Moses doesn't change essentially, I think, as much as Jacob does. And this is the beginning of the establishment of Jacob's character, because you have to know what someone's like before you can see them change. If you want to read it to his discredit, then he's just given up his moral decision-making process to his mother. And he's an adult, right? He's not 11 years old. He couldn't receive the blessing then. He's clearly over bar mitzvah age. So he doesn't really have a right to do that. But if he's someone who wants to escape blame and to get the good stuff anyway, which is reinforced by what we'll see later when God says, I'll protect you, and Jacob says, well, if you do this and you do that and you do the other thing and you bring me home safely and everything's all right, then I'll be your servant, right? Which is what Jacob says to God. If you want to read it to his discredit, then you can see a tremendous arc of moral growth in Jacob over the course of the Torah. If, on the other hand, you want to start Jacob off as a tzaddik and just keep him being a tzaddik all along the way, which is more traditional but less interesting, then you assume that Jacob thought all along, no matter what Rebecca said, that this was going to be his sin. And in fact, it proves to be, because later on, Esau doesn't go to kill Rebecca, right? Who does Esau go to kill? Jacob, because he assumes Jacob stole the birthright and not his mother. Right. Yeah.
Is there any evidence that Rebecca told anybody about Jacob being lord over his brother?
No. No, but the Torah reports that God said it, so it doesn't say Rebecca heard it. Yeah.
This story legitimizes treating your children differently without having good reason for it. When the book said Jacob was more capable of being a leader.
Well, it does. It does, actually. Earlier on, God says that Jacob is the one who's going to be the leader of Israel. So I would say it legitimizes treating your children differently if they're different, which all children are. And that, in fact, treating your children the same is to do violence to their characters, since all children are different. But you have to do it very carefully. And Isaac and Rebecca didn't do it so carefully, which is why one of them ended up trying to kill the other. Right. So, but nobody treats children the same. It's not possible. From the moment they come from the womb, they're different. So it's hard. I mean, the kid who sleeps all night, you don't come into their room at night. The kid who cries seven times during the night gets the parent to come in. You treat them differently. You can't help it. But anyway, so yeah. I don't think any in the various commentaries about whether Jacob is responsible or not, whether he should have done this or not, I don't think any of the Mefarshim, any of the traditional commentators say Jacob's off the hook because it's his mother's doing. So everybody assumes that, you know, yeah.
How do you rationalize with kids this duplicity when you're teaching it to children?
The same way I do here. You talk to them honestly about it. Was this right? You let them make moral judgments, right? At least the way that the Torah is taught in a conservative synagogue is that you actually, based on the morals of the Torah, you can judge the people in the Torah. And based on the morals of the Torah, what Jacob's doing is not right. Even though it's very interesting to make an argument for it, because you can say, well, God said already that he was going to get the birthright. But if God said that he was going to get the birthright, then it's Rebekah's responsibility to convince Isaac to give him the birthright and not to trick him into it. And if Isaac wants to do something contrary to God's will, then that's Isaac's, you know, lookout. But that's how you do it, yeah.
So I don't understand one thing. If the birthright was already given or said by God, it's going to be for Jacob's, what would this blessing be? I mean, you know, wouldn't he be the leader if he had this blessing?
Maybe, maybe not. But if God said, I mean, let me put it this way. If God said that Israel was going to be liberated from slavery one day, why did Moses have to go through all the trouble? Because in the Torah, again and again, that which God says has to be done by human beings. And in fact, a lot of the things that the prophets said were conditional prophecies. That is, they would say, if you repent, you'll get back into the land. The people didn't repent, they didn't get back into the land. So it might be Jacob is intended to be the leader, but human beings always, I think, in the Torah have an ability to thwart God's design if they do the wrong thing.
It seems that there are two different positions. Jacob earlier had already tricked Esau with the lentil soup and said, I want the birthright.
He didn't trick him.
He bargained openly.
He bargained openly with him.
So
right.
It seems to me that it goes through stages. He does it himself with just his brother, but with his father, he can't quite do that himself. And that they're each different tracks. Rivka knows all along, she's got the idea, and she goes, because she's in a different place, she's already struggled with God when she was pregnant, but Jacob is just really developing a relationship, and the first time he does it just directly, and this time he does it another way, and later he encounters God about it in different ways. Remember
the incident with the lentil soup is that Esau is very hungry, and Jacob says, give me your birthright, I'll give you the soup. And Esau spurns the birthright. The problem, there are two problems with it. One is that it's negotiating under duress, which the rabbis generally don't consider a legitimate negotiation. But the other issue is, if in fact that negotiation was real and accepted, then Jacob wouldn't have to do this, right? He already got the birthright. So obviously, there's nothing else to be said about it. And it's clear that everybody assumes that Isaac is going to give the birthright to Esau and that that's his right. And Esau assumes it too, which is why Esau gets upset when he, as you will see, when he doesn't get it. So he got the sheep. I just want to try to at least, we won't finish the chapter, but at least to get to the beginning of the blessing. He got them, prepared them for his mother. His mother prepared a dish such as his father liked. Rebekah took the best clothes of her son Esau, which were in the house, bless you, and had her younger son Jacob put it on. She covered his hands and the hairless part of his neck with the skins of the kids. She put in the hands of her son Jacob the dish and the bread that she had prepared. She adds bread, of course, to make it a meal, even though Isaac didn't ask for bread because he's a man and therefore uncivilized. So, you know, at the Rita Rudner, the comedian, says men are just bears with furniture. But she's a woman. She knows how to make a home, and so she adds a little bread and probably some seasoning. Who knows? He went to his father. Here is obviously the crucial scene. He went to his father and said, "Father," and he said, "Yes. Which of my sons are you? Mi ata bani? Okay, who are you?" Now, here, as we analyzed exhaustively before, and I'm not going to spend a lot of time on it, Jacob says to his father, Anochi Esav Bechorecha, I am Esav, your older son. But the rabbis, in trying to exonerate Jacob, say, I am Esav is your older son. Okay? Now, right, your reaction is a little bit their reaction. It's half playful, half serious. But one of the things that I want us to remember, and you feel it even today, is the rabbis talked about the didn't talk about the biblical heroes in a vacuum. That is, remember that they were defending the Bible against those who attacked it. And people who attacked the Bible would point to the parts of the Bible that seemed morally ambiguous, like this, and say, remember when Reuven Firestone was here last year? He came and he talked about the Quran and the Bible. And he said, the Muslim read of the Bible is, well, of course you guys are so messed up. Look at all your heroes. They all did bad things, right? Look at what Jacob did. Look at what Joseph did. Look at what his brothers did. We think moral ambiguity is great and wonderful and we can analyze them and so on, but if you want religious heroes, it's tough, as is evidenced by Lila's question about what do you tell kids about this. So the rabbis provide the, and when they, you can imagine if you live in a Muslim society and the Muslims are constantly saying your heroes are messed up, what do? You can't just say, yeah, well, they're messed up, that's true, because, because you're not in a secure environment. So instead, you create rationales by which, in fact, they're perfect. And so they, I mean, as far as, you know, King David, who commits the worst atrocity of any hero in the Bible, when not just that he commits adultery, but he sends Bathsheba's husband away to the front lines to be killed so that he can have her, which is really not nice. And even that the rabbis seek to exonerate, and you can see why. David, after all, from the line of David comes the Messiah. So understand that our ability to say this might not be right is largely dependent on the fact that we live in a secure community. And we are comfortable being able to say that heroes aren't always perfect. But for most of Jewish history, that was an almost impossible admission to make. Let me just stop the class for one moment and ask, is it uncomfortable to be in this room because of the sun, and should we move it to a different room? Okay, just wanted to be sure. Okay, yeah. What's that? The ceiling is so high it's hard to hear in the back. I don't know what to do about that other than, yeah. It's a fabulous space. Okay, there you go. So that's how the rabbis seek to exonerate Jacob here. Anochi, I am Esav Bechorcha, right? Esav is your firstborn. But you, Bechorecha, you may choose whichever way you decide to, although the duplicity goes on, Asiti kasher dibarta Eli. I did as you told me to do. And Jacob, of course, and Isaac, of course, never told him to do anything, right? So it's a tough one. It's tough to get Jacob out of this. Anyway, pray, sit, and eat of my game. It's not really game, is it? It's sheep, which I guess it all. I guess my mother was right. It all tastes like chicken. Can you not tell the difference between what Esau hunts and what Isaac brings in from that? I guess not, yeah.
But the thing I've always been hung up on is the issue of the voices.
Right, well, that's why he says the voice is the voice of Jacob at the hands of Esau later on, which, by the way, becomes what you see in verse 22, the voice of Jacob at the hands of Esau, which has become a proverb in Jewish tradition that you might be aware of. When someone speaks nicely but acts cruelly, you say the voice is the voice of Jacob at the hands of Esau. So in Jewish history, for example, when ruling powers would speak nicely to the Jews and then would persecute them, that's what they would say. The voice is the voice of Jacob, the hands of Esau. The voice is... But this is part of the argument for those who say Isaac really knew. Because he says, you sound like Jacob, and he still gives him the blessing. So even if he didn't know, maybe there was on some level an ambiguity in his thought. I mean, is it possible that they got to this age without his knowing that Rebecca really wants Jacob to get the birthright? You know, yeah, of course. There's always denial. That's what I said before. There's no unconditional love, and there's always denial. All you have to do is read the Bible. It will tell you the truth. Yes. Oh, we haven't gotten to that yet, though. We haven't gotten to it yet. Hold it. Hold it. But we haven't gotten to he can't withdraw the blessing. So Jacob says to his father, I'm Esau, your firstborn. I've done as you told me. Pray, sit up, and eat of my game, that you may give me your innermost blessing. Isaac said, how did you succeed so quickly, my son? That was fast. 5 minutes ago, I asked you to. And he said, because the Lord your God granted me good fortune. So you could see them speaking in code. It is possible. How'd you do this so quickly? Remember your God? Remember the one that we share that Esau doesn't so much? Remember that one? He helped me while Esau was out worshiping, you know, Odin and Thor. Isaac said to Jacob. Isaac said to Jacob, come closer that I may feel you, my son, whether you're really my son Esau or not. So Jacob creeped closer, felt him, and wondered the voice of Jacob, yet the hands of Esau. He did not recognize him because his hands were hairy like those of his brother Esau, and so he blessed him. Now, there, the omniscient narrator, that is, the voice of the text, says he didn't know. It says he didn't know. So the argument that he really did know could be a little bit supported by the next verse, but it's hard to make. The next verse is, he asked, are you really my son Esau? And when he said, I am, he said, serve me and let me eat of my son's game that I may give you my innermost blessing. It doesn't say of Esau's game. So he served him and he ate and he brought him wine and drank. And father said, come close and kiss me, my son. He went up and kissed him and he smelled his clothes and blessed him saying, the smell of my son is like the smell of the fields. May God give you the dew of the heaven, the fat of the earth. The blessings we analyzed last time, the different blessings that he gives to Jacob and Esau. So I'm going to just finish with that. Cursed be they that curse you, and blessed they that bless you. Before we finish with that, let's talk about the blessing itself and what the nature of a blessing is. There is a theme in the ancient world, and this will go into your concern, that words once spoken are spoken. You find this, by the way, in the book of Esther. Remember, Ahasuerus issues a decree that you can kill the Jews, and then he can't rescind the decree. All he can do is issue another decree that the Jews can fight back, right? And that's why you get in the ancient world what's called Lashon Sagi Nahor, which means language of sufficient light. You don't say about somebody, he's blind. You say he has enough light. It's a euphemism, it's the exact opposite, but it's because you don't want to use the bad word. Because words once spoken, that's why you can't use God's name. Words once spoken are, right, can't be recalled, they have power and so on. And that's why Kol Nidre is such a big deal, right? Because you actually have to do this major ceremony either to annul vows that you've spoken in the past or that you've spoken in the future, depending on whether you're Sephardic or Ashkenazic, right? One is one is the other. But the idea is that you actually can't take back words. And
how do comedians fit into that?
And it's, how to, yeah. Well, I would say that it's exactly true. When someone says something to you, it's very hard, and the more wounding, the harder it is, to ever forget that the person said that. Right. Even though you may forgive them, but still somewhere inside, you know that they said it. And so the same thing is true in the opposite direction, right? That is, how many times have you seen, for example, in sitcoms that someone will say, I love you, and then they'll realize that they shouldn't have said that, right? And that's the whole sitcom is based on that, but the fact is that I love you hovers above the half hour, because once said, it can't be unsaid. So that's why in every system of morals and ethics, and certainly in the Jewish system, there's constant admonitions to be careful about what you say, right? He's haruba divrechem, because you have to really be careful since you can't unsay it. And that's what happens apparently here to Isaac, especially when you've invoked God's name for a blessing. You can't just say, oops, I was tricked, right? Which may be why Isaac is so careful to establish that it's in fact Esau, because he wants to give the blessing to the right person. Whether he's in fact tricked, that I don't know. Although that's his reaction, is that he's tricked. But yeah.
Doesn't that imply that you're also tricking God? Because the blessing is channeled through Isaac to Jacob, but it's God who ultimately gives the blessing.
In a way. I would say I would say not tricking God, but you're using God's power for something God didn't intend, maybe. But if God gives you the power, so if God wanted it to be God's power alone, then he wouldn't have given it to Isaac, right? And only God would have been able to bless him. I mean, that's the counter argument you could make. Apparently not. I mean, you might think that, but apparently not. Yeah, you certainly could make that argument that if he thought he was blessing Esau, then he's, but I don't know, you signed the contract, you know? So I'm not sure. And then, you know, the only other thing that I'll say is in order to retract it and to give it to Esau, among other things, Isaac would have to overcome the obstacle of Rebekah, who engineered this in the first place. And presumably, Rebekah would not have engineered all this if she thought it was possible or likely for Isaac to just say, oops, I made a mistake, forget that. So I don't know. That is also worth more investigation. But next time we'll do Esau's reaction, and then we're going to send Jacob on his journey, which is really going to be the theme of this year, which is the journey of Jacob. Jacob gets more space in Bereishit, in Genesis, than anyone else, more than Adam, more than Noah, more than Abraham, more than Isaac. Well, Isaac especially. What's that?
More than Joseph?
The Joseph story is the longest story, but the story about Jacob takes up more space. That is, a lot of the Joseph story isn't about Joseph. The Joseph is the longest short story, but in terms of like comments on character and what that person does, Jacob gets more space. You'll see what I mean as we go along, but we will, and also a lot of the Joseph story is about Jacob, if you think about it. It's only really at the end that Jacob no longer is a character. It depends, I guess, how you think about the story. But I don't think we'll get to Joseph this year, which gives you all summer long to read Thomas Mann's Joseph and His Brothers. So it's like a 1,000-page novel of his interpretation of the Joseph story. But please hold on to questions and comments, and I'll see if I can investigate a little bit more about not taking back the blessing, and then we'll look further next time about Jacob and Esau's reaction, which I have to say gives you a lot of compassion for Esau. Poor Esau. He really is upset. And thank you. Welcome back.